Court will proceed to the sixth case, Pinkins v. Buss. Ms. Hardy.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Fran Hardy. I'm a clinical professor and an attorney. I'm here with my co-counsel, Victoria Bailey, and we're privileged to appear this morning on behalf of Darryl Pinkins. Mr. Pinkins is represented pro bono by the Law Clinic at IU School of Law, Indianapolis. Mr. Pinkins seeks relief pursuant to the Sixth Amendment and Strickland. And Strickland is quite a landmark case, and it is indeed alive in this courtroom today. This question before the court of ineffective assistance of counsel is quintessentially a mixed question of law and fact. And under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act and subsequent case interpretation, this court is well aware that it must give extreme deference to the opinion of the Indiana Court of Appeals. Specifically, Mr. Pinkins accepts his burden and has shown that pursuant to 2254D1, the opinion of the Indiana Court of Appeals is both contrary to and an unreasonable application of clearly established Supreme Court precedent. Even with the rigors of the AEDPA, the law remains that the Indiana Court of Appeals must faithfully apply Strickland. Because the Indiana Court did not, this court must reverse. The facts relevant to this claim are presented in the trial record and a post-conviction record that are before this court. The facts have been discussed exhaustively in the brief. However, as this is a mixed question, we will review these critical facts to give life to our legal argument. I begin with a dozing, disabled trial counsel. Those facts are of record. The facts underscore a deficient performance with extreme prejudice.
How did they establish the fact that he was dozing it?
He admitted it at the post-conviction hearing that he dozed during the proceedings, and the Indiana Court of Appeals found that he dozed during the testimony of Kim Epperson. He testified during the post-conviction proceedings.
That was during the direct exam, though. He cross-examined her, didn't he?
He did indeed cross-examine her, Your Honor, but without knowing the difference between serology and DNA. As he acknowledged in his post-conviction testimony, his cross-examination was based on lack of knowledge, ignorance of the difference between serology and DNA. The court is well aware that lawyers during trial must be prepared. They must, during trial, continue to observe, listen, and consider throughout. It's a constant duty. Trials are fluid, and to be effective, you must practice both the art and science of advocacy. Now, Counsel Drosta had reason for his disabilities, reasons for this deficient performance with prejudice. He had a polyp in his nasal passage that caused constant lack of oxygen. His condition was not diagnosed at the time of the trial. However, he knew of his symptoms. He was taking no-dose constantly during this trial, and he told his client to poke him if he fell asleep. The record reflects these facts. The record, again, reflects that he actually slept during the testimony of Kim Epperson, and that Kim Epperson was a state's witness on serology. That testimony will be addressed further in just a moment. In his ill-prepared, disabled, dozing state, Drosta decided, and I'm using the term decided very loosely, to open the door and let all the evidence in. Not only did he open the door to the state's proffer, he offered negative evidence himself. Consider the testimony of Jill Martin, whose car was rear-ended earlier that evening by a car matching the description of the assailant's car. Martin had offered no ID of this defendant whatsoever, and yet on cross, Drosta had her identify his client, the relative size of his client, as matching the size of the man she had seen that night. He proffered negative evidence against his client constantly. Drosta's approach to the evidence continued throughout the trial. He continued to open the door and, in his words, let the light shine in. And we claim this is quite a dark light. There were serology facts that were prejudicial and without probative value in the face of the DNA results. There was identification facts that were unreliable and inadmissible. There were character evidence facts that these facts would not have seen the light of day in a fair trial, and they were not objected to by defense counsel, and in some situations, offered. Serology facts. Karen Epperson was a state's witness. She worked for the state. She has this aura of infallibility as a state's witness. And her testimony is included in hundreds of pages of this transcript. Epperson told the jury, and her facts were emphasized in closing as set forth in our brief, that her serology findings could connect Mr. Pinkins to the biological evidence, although DNA facts and tests excluded him as a contributor to those stains. He was excluded by individual DNA testing, and the state offered a witness that said, pursuant to serology, he could be in the group of people. But he had already been excluded as the individual capable of leaving that stain. The lawyer let this evidence in without objection, didn't know the difference between DNA and serology. The state argued that serology in this case could do what DNA could not, and that was false testimony, and his client slept through it and opened the door to it. He didn't know the difference. Now consider the facts surrounding the identification, an unchallenged identification by the victim. This crime happens December 89, arrest January 2nd, 90. The police officer, within 2 weeks of this arrest, takes five photos of five men arrested to her home to show them to her. No physical lineup, no photo lineup, none whatsoever. At trial, the victim testifies that she had them in her hand and that she glanced at them, but denied that she looked at them. Again, May 1990, 5 months after the arrest.
Let me go back. Yeah, the witness said she didn't want to look at them, correct?
Yes, ma'am. But
that's what she told the
officers. Yes, Your Honor. But there are records, there are facts in the records that show she held them in her hand, that they were on a coffee table in front of her, that they were large, that her husband looked at them one at a time. She did admit that she glanced at them and had them in her hand. And then in May 90, she's told when the pretrials are. There's been no physical lineup, no photo lineup. She knows when the pretrials are. She comes to the May 1990 pretrial, and she makes what she claims to be an identification of Mr. Pinkins, who's out of jail. He enters the courtroom, and she identifies him. There's discrepancies in the detective's testimony in regard to that ID, discrepancies between what he said at trial and what he said in the post-conviction hearing in regard to when Detective Solon first learned of that ID. But we do know that in 1991, the victim was called for a discovery deposition, and a few days before that discovery deposition, the state showed her a single photo of Mr. Pinkins. A single photo. No physical lineups, no photo lineups. Takes the pictures to her house. She comes to the pretrial. She's shown a single picture before a deposition. And at trial, again, when the admissibility of these identifications of Mr. Pinkins are so unreliable, counsel makes no objection to the admissibility. Open the door. Let the light shine in.
Professor Hardy, if I could take you back for a second to the seriology
issue. Yes, Your Honor.
Was that ever presented to any Indiana court?
Yes. Your Honor, it was in the briefs. It's not mentioned in the Court of Appeals opinion at all. I don't think the word serology shows, but it certainly was in the briefs, Your Honor. And as we've cited in our brief, Lisa Black, state police supervisor, testified that Epperson's testimony was inconsistent with the DNA results. Now, beyond serology that points to a biological match when DNA does not, beyond admissible in a court of D, there was this character evidence that's just throughout the trial. Mr. Drosta himself proffers character evidence against his client, evidence that his client went to bars, strip bars, that at those strip bars there were naked ladies that danced for drinks. That's the testimony offered by defense counsel. The dangers posed by character evidence are well known by this court, but here the attorney permitted it. We recognize that the state court decision is what this court will review if it finds merit to our constitutional claim. We urge this court that the state court did identify Strickland but did not apply it correctly or reasonably to these facts. Their decision is flawed because it fails any cumulative analysis, and it's flawed because of their partial reliance on erroneous factual findings that highlight that unreasonableness. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Hardy. Mr. Kobe?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Kobe. I'm here representing respondent Ed Buss in this action. This court should affirm the decision of the district court. While the petitioner this morning described the standards to which he is being held, the argument then moves past those standards and attempts to argue claims of ineffective assistance of counsel as if this court were hearing a direct appeal. If you look at the four claims of ineffective assistance of counsel that the petitioner raises in his brief, only two of those are available for review by this court because of the doctrine of procedural default. Those two are the failure to object to the in-court identification and the failure to object to the character evidence with regard to the adult entertainment evidence. As far as the remaining two claims, the claim that trial counsel mishandled the DNA and serology evidence and the claim that trial counsel dozed during trial are not preserved. The claim that trial counsel didn't properly handle the DNA or serology evidence was never presented to the Indiana State Courts at all. Not in the brief to the Indiana Court of Appeals or in the petition to transfer to the Indiana Supreme Court. The dozing claim was presented to the appellate court, the intermediate appellate court, the Indiana Court of Appeals, but then it was omitted from the petitioner's petition for transfer to the Indiana Supreme Court. And as the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear in O'Sullivan v. Borkel, in order to preserve claims for review in federal habeas corpus, a petitioner must present those claims at all stages of the litigation. Looking at the preserved claims, the in-court identification of petitioner was not tainted by an unduly suggestive pre-trial identification. Petitioner points out that the detective did take pictures shortly after the crime to the victim's house. The victim had indicated the night that she reported the incident that she didn't think she could identify any of her attackers. She was so shaken up at that point. So the officer was going to take over pictures of people that had been arrested if the victim wanted to look at them. The victim refused to look at them, and they were placed on the dining room table. They were sitting at the dining room table, and she pushed them away, saying, "I don't want to look at them." The photograph that was on the top of that stack was actually of Glenn, another arrestee in this and perpetrator of this, not the petitioner. Both the post-conviction trial court and the Indiana Court of Appeals found that the victim did not view those photographs, and particularly the photograph of the petitioner at that meeting at her home.
So the photos were in a stack?
Correct.
They were not spread out?
No, they were not spread out.
As counsel said, that the husband looked at them individually, one by one.
The husband testified at post-conviction that he picked up the stack and went through them and looked at them one by one. But he said that his wife did not see them, and the detective testified that the wife did not see them, and the victim herself testified, "I did not look at them. I pushed, at most, the only time I touched them was to push them away and say, I don't want to look at those." The pretrial hearing identification by the victim was not only unduly suggestive. It was a busy courtroom morning. There were several cases to be heard that morning. It was a packed courtroom. The victim decided to attend that day, not on the prompting by anybody by the state. And when the defendant walked in alone in street clothes, the victim saw him and said, that's the individual that came up to me first when my car was struck.
So then she just showed up at court.
Right.
She had no idea that this case was being called that day.
She knew that the case would be called that day, but it was morning court for that particular criminal court. So they were hearing all sorts of initial hearings, bond reductions. I mean, it was a normal criminal case morning, and it was a packed courtroom. I think that there was testimony about how many people were in the courtroom, and I think it was over 50. It was a busy morning at court with many cases being heard. And it's also interesting to note that there were other defendants, other co-perpetrators that were there that day, and the victim didn't identify any of them. But she saw the petitioner and knew that as soon as she saw him, that was the individual that approached her car. Photograph before the deposition occurred after she had already identified the petitioner, and she was shown the photograph to discuss facial hair and what the petitioner's facial hair looked like at the time that he approached her. That's clearly not unduly suggestive pretrial lineup. She'd already identified him, so showing a picture to discuss facial hair wouldn't have rendered it inadmissible. And finally, as the Indiana Court of Appeals found, they found that, first of all, there's no ineffective assistance because an objection wouldn't have been sustained. But even had an objection been sustained, that there had been an unduly suggestive pretrial identification, that the victim had sufficient independent recognition that she could testify in court. At the time that she viewed the petitioner, the headlights from his car were shining. There was a street lamp, so the lighting all around the time. She had sufficient time to view him. They spoke. They had a short conversation. He asked if she was all right and talking about her car. So there was sufficient time for her to recognize the petitioner then and then come into court and identify him. On the failure to object to the adult entertainment evidence, first of all, this was a strategic decision by counsel because an objection wouldn't have been sustained. So rather than – it was clear that his strategy was before the jury to show the jury that the defense wasn't afraid of the evidence the state had. This was a circumstantial case, and the strategy was, look, let the state show you all they have, and it's not enough. So defense counsel's strategy was, I'm not going to, before the jury, object to something that I couldn't keep out anyways. The petitioner cites to no state court law that would prevent the admission of this evidence. The evidence was probative for two reasons. The license plate that was used on the car that struck the victim was stolen from outside the Interlude Motel, one of these establishments. And the evidence also came in regarding the type of clothing that petitioner usually wore from the security guard that worked at one of these establishments and one of the waitresses there. That was big in this case. The victim was attacked by five men, and she was able to give descriptions in order of the attacks about what kind of clothes they wore, how tall they were, general indications like this. So the evidence from these adult entertainment establishments was used to establish the petitioner's clothing and also William Durden's clothing, army fatigues, a jacket that he would usually wear, and he was a co-perpetrator with petitioner, and petitioner's alibi was tied with William Durden that night. He said he was with him, so they tried to stick together as their alibi, so inculpating Durden also inculpated the petitioner. I'd just like to say one last thing in regard to the serology and the DNA evidence. This case was never based on scientific evidence. The state actually had to overcome the scientific evidence here because the DNA evidence excluded petitioner as one of the contributors. There were two profiles in addition to the victim that were developed from the biological evidence here, and they excluded the defendant on both of those. So the state had to overcome that throughout this trial, and at no point did they base the case on scientific evidence, but they had to overcome that. I would ask that this court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Professor Hardy.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The estate did base its case on scientific evidence. It takes nothing further than a read of the closing argument by the state to see where the state said all facts point to Daryl Pinkins, including the serology facts. Serology can tell you what DNA cannot. That's what's in the closing argument. They did indeed rely on the science. It was hundreds of pages.
Mr. Kobe's point, Professor, that on petition for transfer to the Indiana Supreme Court, that the issue wasn't presented there.
The issue of ineffective assistance of counsel was raised as a claim in the petition to transfer.
That spoke to the inattentiveness by dozing?
In the petition for transfer, it's a short 4 to 5 page document, and it does not recite the entire brief. It refers to the brief and refers to the record and refers to the Indiana Court of Appeals opinion. So in his petition for transfer, he does indeed raise the legal claim, and he sets forth brief argument in support of it without...
A justice of the Indiana Supreme Court, a fair reading of that petition would alert him, the justice, to this issue?
Absolutely, Judge. It's in the brief. It's undoubtedly in the brief in multiple forms.
Right. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you,
Ms. Bailey. Mr. Kobe, the case is taken under advisement. The court